And welcome to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak in for Marty Musk-Hawain. Just about any 20-something will tell you that adulting is hard work, but parenting young adults can be challenging too. Just when they're reaching the age of independence, societal forces are making it difficult for them to gain traction. Student loan debt, the COVID-19 pandemic that forced many to move back home, and the resulting mental health challenges have made adulting more difficult for kids and their parents. This hour, parenting young adults. How do we make sure they have the life skills they need to navigate an increasingly complicated world? And how do we recognize and course correct when helping them is actually hurting them? Our guests are Julie Lithcott-Hames, former dean at Stanford University, and author of How to Raise an Adult and Your Turn, How to Be an Adult. She has also written a memoir, Real American. Julie Lithcott-Hames, welcome to Radio Times.
Tracy, thanks so much for having me. Always a pleasure to be in Philadelphia, even though I live in California.
Well, we're glad to have you with us. And also joining us is Dr. Anthony Rostain, Chief and Chair of Psychiatry and Behavioral Health at Cooper University Healthcare and Professor of Psychiatry and Pediatrics at Cooper Medical School of Rowan University. He co-authored the book, along with Dr. Janet Hibbs, The Stressed Years of Their Lives, and the forthcoming You're Not Done Yet about parenting young adults. Dr. Rostain, welcome to Radio Times.
I'm delighted to be here. Thanks for having me.
So, Julie, I'll begin with you. Why is it that there are not more resources for parents of young adults? There's lots of books for raising toddlers and young children, but not so much for the young adults. Why is that?
Tracy, it's a beautiful question, and I think the fact of it is that things have changed. The way in which young people have been raised has changed, such that maybe they're a little less prepared to take on the skills of adulthood. But at the same time, we've also had systemic changes. You mentioned they're more likely to have student loan debt. And going along with that, the cost of living in many regions, including yours and mine, has risen, such that when you look at their loan debt and you look at the cost of living, their wages and salaries have simply not kept up. So they can't enjoy the financial independence that you might have enjoyed and I might have, and certainly older generations did when they were the very same age of our young adults now.
And that makes it more challenging for parents, Julie, because there just are not a lot of guidebooks. There's not a playbook for this to a large degree. I mean, obviously, your books are very helpful. Dr. Rostain and his colleagues have written some books, but there's just not a lot of resources. So parents are sort of figuring it out as they go.
We are figuring it out together. That is absolutely true. And I think the good news is it doesn't require spending a lot of money. It doesn't require a lot of sacrifice. It's really about shifting or repatterning our behaviors with our children and young adults so that we can get out of the driver's seat and help them get into the driver's seat in a way that isn't scary, but is empowering. And we can do that.
Yeah, and that's exactly what we'd like to talk about in this conversation, how we do that. Dr. Rostain, in the years between 18 and 29, which have come to be called emerging adulthood, what's going on in that young person developmentally during that years? I guess that would be the first question, and then we can talk about what that means for their relationship with their parents. But
sure.
Developmentally, what's happening?
Well, you know, over the last two decades or so, we've been thankful to the work of Jeffrey Arnett and colleagues defining this period as emerging adulthood, right? And there are tasks that are going on that young people want to accomplish. The first is exploring their identity. You know, who are they? Who do they want to be? What kinds of future are they trying to build? They're also trying to practice and get better at managing their driving their car, so to speak, as we just heard. But at the same time, there's a lot of feelings of instability and of not being sure, being in between, feeling that, you know, I'm not an adult yet, but I'm not a teenager or an adolescent, so how do I practice and get better at managing life? A lot of self-preoccupation, okay, a lot of thinking about themselves. So sometimes parents think, oh, my kid's being rather self-centered. Well, that's absolutely fine because they are trying to figure themselves out. And especially those that have had a hard time, have encountered some detours or some obstacles, they may not feel as prepared, so to speak. And then, of course, thinking about the future and the sense of possibilities and, you know, as we heard Julie say, the future is actually more uncertain now than it was a couple of decades ago. And so that sense of apprehension of not knowing what's in store may fuel a greater sense of being unprepared. So we encounter young people who are, on the one hand, excited, looking ahead, wanting to figure out who they are, trying new things. But at the same time, since so much is changing, they often feel underprepared and or maybe over-dependent on their parents. And that's exactly what we're here to talk about, is what's okay and what's not okay with respect to that, with the interdependence and the relationship that emerges in this decade.
Yeah, and that can create that period of sort of figuring it all out, can create friction with parents.
Well, especially because maybe parents, when they were younger, had it all figured out, right? By the mid-20s, they knew what they wanted to do. They were already living on their own. They were financially independent. You know, all the signs of adulthood they'd started to achieve. Whereas now a lot of kids, in fact, it's important to say, this for the first time in over 100 years, the majority of people in their 20s are living with their parents and their families. And that's a trend that began before the pandemic, but was accelerated, again, because of all these changes in the economic opportunities and in the requirements of being successful.
Julie, I want to talk about parents a little bit and your experience at Stanford when you were dean of freshmen. During your time there, you witnessed a growing trend of what you might call over-parenting. What did that look like?
Yeah, so I was dean of freshmen at Stanford 2002 to 2012. And so I saw on my campus what faculty and administrative staff were seeing on every campus in America. So what I'm describing is not a Stanford thing, but a change in childhood that was now manifesting itself at the college and university level. And basically, the curious behaviors were parents who seemed to think their son or daughter was not capable of doing the routine work of being a college student. So parents wanting to register their student for class, parents wanting to have a conversation with a faculty member about a grade, parents getting concerned about roommates not getting along, parents wanting to be the one to solve it. And so It concurrent with that was young adults who seemed okay with parents registering them for class or talking to faculty on their behalf or getting involved in a roommate situation. And so what I found bewildering as a member of the Gen X generation was, why don't these young mind the fact that their parents are kind of butting in or taking over or handling things? I found it curious in the earlier, certainly when it was less common. Of course, nowadays, the types of behaviors I've described are incredibly common. And Facebook parenting groups for every college have sprung up. So parents themselves are talking with each other about, how are we going to handle this? And have you handled that? We've really, as parents, began switching our pronouns. We say we when we mean my kid. And I think that's an example of, at the very, you know, sort of molecular level, of what has changed in the minds of parents. I have to handle it. I will handle it. I'm slightly worried my kid can't handle it. And if parents keep handling it, the kid actually is deprived of the very experiences that would teach them how.
Well, exactly. And Dr. Rothstein, does that lead then to a sort of learned helplessness in the student?
Well, again, I don't want to generalize, okay? Some students are, in fact, expecting their parents to help them, right? So it's a mutual reinforcing system, right? And if I wanted to take a step back and say, I completely agree with what Julie's saying as far as the secular changes in those years, right? There was suddenly more anxiety. So one important backdrop to all this, and this is what Dr. Hibbs and I have been thinking about a lot, is how has the cultural anxiety risen to the point where people do feel afraid of making mistakes? They don't feel as sure of themselves. You know, when we're anxious, we're second-guessing ourselves all the time. So if, you know, plus the stakes are higher, right? College education costs have gone up. Getting kids into, especially schools that are very selective, is like a process that began pre-K. Yeah. And so this whole, what we're really seeing is the manifestation of a cultural shift in which parents actually believe what Julie was saying. They actually believe that if they're not doing this, quote, intensive parenting, somehow they're not being good parents. So we try to change that conversation around by saying, well, maybe it's better to understand that your anxiety, you need to look at your own anxiety. You need to look at what you're most afraid of so that you're not transmitting it inadvertently to your child, and then to begin a conversation, because we can't legislate this, we can't mandate this. There's no there's no guidebook exactly. Although I think
your book and there's my book.
I know. Well, we're trying to come up with those ideas. We're trying, but it's a really it's partly to learn how to calm down and how to really begin to think, where can I pull back a little bit, and do it in a way that's, you know, in a dialogue with your child, and also with understanding, and I think understanding what is being expected of your child, which I think is a good thing that universities are now talking to parents and saying things like, hey, we're expecting your kid to be able to get up in the morning and get their day going. I mean, the story I love to tell is that I got a call from a parent whose child was coming to Penn, because I was at Penn for 40 years, and they said, you're the guy who runs the ADD program. Would you be able to offer, my son has ADHD, would you be able to offer a wake-up service for your son, for my son?
Right.
And I said, hold on. I said, I'm glad he's gotten into Penn. It's great school, but he's got to figure out how to get himself up in the morning. Otherwise, it may not work out here. So that's the kind of messaging parents need, is to say, start getting them ready before to do things on their own.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And then that's frankly what my first book was about, How to Raise an Adult. And the very story you just told, I just literally told myself. I was on the road in Colorado and Tennessee this week talking to parents, talking to young adults also. And I use the wake-up example because I'm saying to parents, our job is to put ourselves out of a job. If you have not taught your kid how to wake up by themselves to an alarm, to be accountable to that situation of I've got to be somewhere at 7 or 8 or 10 a.m., you know, that's on us. We were supposed to teach that in the 5th grade, if not then the 7th grade. If not then, definitely the 9th grade.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're going to be that person waking. You're going to decide the stakes are too high. Now they're a junior. I can't not wake them up because everything matters for their future. And you can see how it snowballs and we end up with the best of intentions. And let me underscore that, because I'm a mom. I've got a 23-year-old. I got a 21-year-old, y'all. I am in this myself as a parent. I get it. And yet, because, like Tony, I worked on a college campus and I've seen the sort of the result of not having prepared them to be accountable to an alarm clock, to wake up, you know, and be responsible for themselves in that day, you know, we have underserved them. And that's what I'm really invested in, helping all of us counteract and repattern.
Yeah, and it sounds like what I'm hearing from both of you is that parents in this day and age, maybe as opposed to our parents in earlier generations, the dynamic is different, the anxieties are different, the stakes feel so much higher, that we have invested ourselves in certain areas to the neglect of other areas with our students, namely life skills, because we're getting them ready to get into the best colleges or get the best jobs or whatever it might be. There's so much more to talk about on this topic. We are talking about parenting young adults and trying to figure out what is the roadmap to helping them get to their best selves. That's what we're talking about on Radio Times. Much more to come when we come right back. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. We're talking about parenting young adults and the fact that there are lots of resources for parents of young children, not as many for parents of young adults. And dynamics have changed over the years, and parents are trying to figure out how to get their children either through college or into the workforce, and to do that in a way that allows them to be productive and independent, or at least interdependent, citizens. So that's what we're talking about today. We invite you to add your voice to our conversation. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes, or give us a call at 888-477-9499. Our guests are Julie Lithcott-Hames. She is a former dean at Stanford University. She's the author of How to Raise an Adult and also of Your Turn, How to Be an Adult. Also with us is Dr. Anthony Rostain, who is the chief and chair of psychiatry and behavioral health at Cooper University Healthcare. He is the co-author of the book, The Stressed Years of Their Lives, Helping Your Kids Survive and Thrive During Their College Years. So that's where we are. That's what we're talking about. Dr. Rostain, we were talking about how the dynamics have changed over the years and parents have put so much of their energy into either getting their children into the best colleges or making sure that they're ready to enter the workforce, sometimes to the neglect of basic life skills. There's been a different sort of emphasis. And I wonder if, on some level, this is also in part a response to or even a backlash to the more hands-off style of parenting that earlier generations did. I think back to my growing up years, and my parents were not scheduling play dates. They were not chauffeuring me to 10 activities.
That's so insightful. Well, you know, again, these things happen in sort of epical shifts. Yeah. The pendulum swings. So you grew up, and I grew up, I think, a little before you, but we grew up in a time where parents were more comfortable giving lots of freedom. Things, the world seemed quite, you know, safe. And you know, it was the post-war years. Everybody thought, okay, we're on the road to progress and affluence or what have you as a society. In the intervening decades, the world has gotten a lot more complicated. And we know, for example, that the future is seemingly less positive to young people. When you talk to young people today, they are really worried about things like climate change, things like, you know, violence and in schools, the political polarization, you know, and where are they going to fit in and how are they going to succeed in a world that's constantly changing? And I think parents also feel at a loss. So one of the most important messages from our first book and also from this new one, You're Not Done Yet, is that parents have to start to really look at their own reflexive and reactionary kinds of emotions and begin to dial them down and really begin to reflect, you know, like, how did you get to be who you are? What kinds of steps did it take for you to figure it out, right? And it wasn't so easy. And what makes it harder or easier for a child may be different for your child, may be different for what was important to you. So understanding who your child is as a growing person and being careful not to project onto that child what your needs or goals or aspirations are. And Julie mentioned a little bit of this later. It's like, you know, a parent shouldn't be choosing their kids' courses. You know, it's really, and the other is to help your child make those choices requires conversations, not just with you, but with other people around who might be mentors and people they look up to. So, yeah, thinking about how there's a certain amount of uncertainty we need to learn to live with, and not making it worse than it is, not catastrophizing, because at the core of anxiety in all of us is this fear that something bad is going to happen if we can't control everything. Yeah. And the truth is, as we learned in the pandemic, you can't control everything. You have to learn to control what is within your power to plan and predict and keep yourself safe. And then the rest is really learning how to roll with it, learning how to flow with the changes. And of course, that's easier said than done. Yeah.
I needed to hear that today. Thank you for saying that. If we take nothing else from the conversation, we're going to take that. Let me also invite any 20-somethings who might be listening to give us a call. Shoot us an email. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. If you're a 20-something, you're probably tweeting. So that would be at WHYY Radio Times. If you're really old school and you want to call us, 888-477-9499. But we'd love to hear your experiences, your questions for our guests as well. Julie, I want to talk about the life skills that you think parents do need to be paying attention to and instilling in their children, along with all of the other things. I mean, we certainly talked about, you know, being able to get yourself out of bed in the morning and get where you need to go. But what are some kind of key life skills that you think parents need to be really intentional about passing on?
I want to share that. I'd also like to just step back a little bit in response to what Tony's just been saying, if I may. You and Tony are using the word child to refer to college students, and that's not uncommon these days. I will point out that we didn't used to call college students children. We called them students. We called them young men and women or men and women. And it's an example of how our linguistic choices are reflecting our fears, our anxieties, and our choices. There are also a lot of people listening to us right now who are saying, after 27 minutes of listening, wait a minute, give me a break. You know, these privileged kids, come on. Okay. Dr. Jeffrey Arnett's work is important, emerging adulthood, but it seems to be his findings really track middle class and upper middle class kids. There were plenty of less privileged kids at Stanford when I was a dean who actually were more skilled than their affluent counterparts. That I found fascinating. The kids who'd had a rougher start in life came to college with more life skills. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was a beautiful irony. So I don't want us to overlook the fact that class, that is middle class status, upper middle class and status, and wealth are contributing to a lack of skills in our kids. It is those of us with the means, like time and money, to micromanage or intensely cultivate our children's lives who are doing so. And parents who are working class, who have one and two and three jobs to try to put a roof over a kid's head and food on the table, they don't have the time to micromanage their kids every moment. And their kids emerge from this childhood, maybe traumatized by aspects of it. I'm not trying to romanticize economic struggle, but they do have an extra tray in their toolkit. Whereas those of us who are more affluent are saying, if I'm in it and involved, I can control it. It'll be fine. And my thought is, well, what's your long-term strategy? Because mm-hmm. one day you'll be dead and gone, and you don't want your very adult offspring at that point to be bewildered. The changes we're talking about are not in response to the pandemic or the political divide or the climate clapping back. These changes that began this movement called helicopter parenting were in place starting in the mid-1980s when boomers were raising millennials. Okay, when things were good, when life seemed good, we were prosperous, everything was fine. This isn't, you know, we are now responding to existential threats we didn't have then, but this manner of parenting has been around for a long time. So let me finally answer your question, which is to say the life skills are things like be able to wake yourself up, take care of your body, your bills, your belongings, take transportation or get yourself to wherever you need to go, make food, interact with strangers. How about that one? We've raised two generations now. Don't talk to strangers, which is not a life skill. The life skill is how to conduct yourself out in the world in a way that keeps you safe, but also allows you to get your needs met while helping others. You got to talk to strangers, and you have to learn to develop the instincts around which stranger is the one creepy stranger out there when 99% of strangers are totally fine.
Yeah. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY. We are talking about parenting young adults. Got an email here from Kathy who says it starts way before college. Parents don't allow their children to take on responsibilities at a young age, so kids go to college without basic life skills. They being parents, are enablers, raising dependent children, not to put a burden on schools, but there should be more life skills taught there too. And I think, Dr. Rothstein, that Kathy raises an important point about, you know, schools, as well as the fact that not everybody is going to college, but everybody needs to have these life skills no matter what their path is when they graduate from high school.
Well, absolutely. And I just want to play off what Julie said. I do agree that in many cases there are these economic differences, and the challenge of taking care of yourself is something that has to start early. And I'm glad that, you know, you raise that point of how when parents are working hard at different jobs, you know, young people have to step up and do more to take care of things around the house, to contribute to the family, and to take care of themselves. You know, but I want to get away from what I think I want to really say is I don't think parent blaming or calling people enablers is the right direction to go. It's really to understand what's fueling this pattern behind the scenes. And I do agree that we have to do a better job as a society for preparing kids to take care of themselves. We used to have, when I was in high school, there were classes like home economics and learning how to do a budget, learning how to take care of your life. None of that exists anymore, and that's too bad, because we're sort of expecting parents to do all of the teaching about, you know, growing up, so to speak. Okay. And the other is really, and a huge issue, is this question of, is college the right path or not? You know, it's beginning to be questioned more and more. Figuring out what you want to do with your life, your vocational direction, understanding what you need to do in order to get there, and having real work experiences. You know, the kids that work in, you know, work after school, have jobs, they actually do mature more quickly because mm-hmm. they're used to having to balance time, you know, between what they're studying. And again, I'm not romanticizing it, as to quote Julie, but it is important for learning time management, prioritization. These are executive functioning skills that we know predict success in life more than intelligence. The ability to take care of yourself and think about the future and work towards that future rather than getting caught up in either distractions, which unfortunately are all around us, getting sucked into like the internet or social media rather than doing your homework or doing your, you know, practicing whatever you're trying to practice if you're trying to get better at an instrument or even just holding a job. These are skills that I think are survival skills that parents ought to think about. Where is their kid in those domains? Yeah. And some of the time, I agree that parents feel themselves obliged to fill in what's missing. And so it becomes, again, this reinforcing cycle. And instead, it ought to be, say, let's stop and think and say, okay, what can we change here if it's not working? I will add that another mindset we think that needs to be addressed is this mindset of it should all be fine all the time. You know, everything should be fine. And it's like this instant gratification culture, right? If I don't have an answer now, I need to, what's, something's wrong. Well, some of this takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of trial and error, and it takes a willingness to make mistakes. The fear of making mistakes and this kind of heightened sense of vulnerability if you do make a mistake makes it very hard for people to take on new roles, try new skills, for parents to step back, for them to feel okay that if their kid doesn't get it, hit it right on their first job, it's not the end of the world. But that kind of, you know, practicing these skills, practicing these conversations is something that, you know, I think we all need to give parents respect that this is what parenting is about. Yeah. When you have a young adult in your family. It's about listening. It's about not being the director. It's more being the consultant, you know, and being someone who can, you know, if you need my input, I'll give it to you, rather than immediately coming up with the solution,
yeah,
right?
Giving it's a people, shift in the role.
It's a shift in the role, and I think that's the important thing. And it's hard. This culture makes it hard because parents feel responsible for everything that happens to their, you know, to their kids. So we're moving again. It's moving from trying to use power to more persuasion, and from talking to your kids to listening, and from, you know, just respectful guidance, not telling kids, if you don't get up and do this, something terrible is going to happen.
Yeah. I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about mental health, because there has been a lot of conversation about mental health as it relates to young people, particularly in the time since COVID, and how anxieties have been heightened all around. Julie, I'd like you to address that, if you would, about the mental health challenges that young adults are facing, the specific stressors, and we've mentioned a couple of them here, but then also to kind of narrow the focus a little bit, young people of color, LGBTQ kids who may have more specific anxieties and mental health concerns. Talk about that, if you would.
Well, unlike Tony, I'm not a clinician, a practitioner. I'm a former lawyer. I became a university dean, and I really researched the problem of what is happening to our young adults based on what I was seeing on my campus. And How to Raise an Adult is a heavily researched book in that regard. And what I learned is that agency or self-efficacy, these foundational concepts of our own existence, is really key to whether somebody's going to have good mental health or poor mental health. And that's how this all connects. So when parents are overmanaging their kids' lives, they are really undermining the kids' ability to develop that sense of I can do stuff, I am capable, my parents believe I am capable, I will try, I will keep going. All of that life experience and the trial and error builds agency in a kid. And if you don't have agency, research shows you're more likely to have anxiety, you're more likely to have depression, and you're more likely to not have executive function. And so here we have a generation of young adults who, and there are all kinds of reasons why somebody can develop anxiety and depression, which I'm sure Tony can tell us about. But certainly being overattended in childhood is correlated with that. And yes, then these systemic factors, the pandemic, the climate clapping back angrily, the notion of what's happening in our schools in terms of active shooter drills and the political divide. There's a lot existential or external to a young person that can make them really fear for the future and feel anxious. And kids of color and kids who are queer and kids who are poor And kids who are in other ways on the margins or less seen or understood are that much more likely to be struggling and probably that much more likely to not have access to the resources in their school or their hometown, because accessing mental health resources does take a certain amount of economic privilege unless you really know how to navigate the system of subsidized care that's available.
Well, and on that point, I wanted to ask you, Dr. Rothstein, about whether, A, you think that young people are generally more receptive now
yes.
to therapy than generations
yes. There's
past.
Definitely evidence for that. Gen Z is much more willing to talk about what's going on with them and looking for help, which is it's a good news from my point of view, because
yeah.
then it's not sort of swept under the rug and people are ready to say, I need help, okay? Although there are still a group of people that resist that, right, because they're mm-hmm. either feeling it's something shameful about asking mm-hmm. for help or something, you know, that they're really afraid to face. However, I love what Julie just said, this notion of agency, you know, it is up to you to sort of take stock of what's going on in your life when you're in how do I change things? How do I make things move in the direction that I want them to move? And that's, you know, that requires a sense of support from the people around you that you can get the help if you need it. One of the problems we're facing is the resources themselves
yeah.
for both on college, you know, college counseling programs now are swamped with
yeah.
kids seeking yeah. help.
As are therapists generally.
And the yeah. therapists, yeah. So I'm very worried about access to health care, mental health care especially. And I'm worried that, you know, as a result, what will happen is that kids will look elsewhere for the kinds of help, maybe not from the best sources,
yeah.
okay? Kind of using the internet to tell them things that may not be all that accurate or reliable or factual.
Yeah. Much more to talk about. We are discussing parenting young adults here on Radio Times. We welcome you to join in our conversation. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. We're talking about parenting young adults. There are not nearly as many resources for parents of young adults as there are for parents of young children. And as the dynamics are changing in the way that we live day in and day out, all that we've been through with COVID and so forth, everybody is just trying to sort of feel their way and help their young adults as best they can. We happen to have two experts who can help all of us with that. Julie Lithcott-Hames is a former dean at Stanford. She's also the author of How to Raise an Adult and also the book Your Turn, How to Be an Adult. Dr. Anthony Rothstein is with us. He's the chief and chair of psychiatry and behavioral health at Cooper University Healthcare. He is also the co-author of The Stressed Years of Their Lives, Helping Your Kid Survive and Thrive During Their College Years. Dr. Rothstein, I want to go back to you because there was a thought that you wanted to express before we move on in our conversation, picking up from where we were before.
Well, the theme that I wanted to touch on, and this is really what motivates Dr. Hibbs and me to write this second book about, you know, you're not done yet, is that a lot of mental health providers for young adults tend to, you know, exclude parents or at least push them aside and say, you know, no, I just need to see the young person. And we really think that that's no longer really a viable paradigm. If you're in your 20s and you're dealing with serious depression or anxiety or a host of other what I would call mental disorders that are of great concern, including substance abuse and trauma, we think that families could play a big role in helping that young person. And so the paradigm really needs, especially if anybody's listening to this show and thinking your 20-something is struggling right now and they're going to see somebody, but I have no clue what's going on and I don't see any progress. It's not that the parent should immediately say, tell me exactly what's going on in therapy, because that's not going to work. But the question really ought to be, is there any chance that your therapist would want to hear from us because we're worried? And our view as family systems therapists is that we have to understand all of the problems that our patient may have, understand the different perspectives that others in their life in their lives have on them, because ultimately the family can be a resource. It doesn't strictly have to stay outside. And from the standpoint of parents, whatever they can offer is minimized if they're not invited in. And yeah. then they become more anxious, and then the dynamics become, you know, more and more complicated. So I just think we have to begin to say to young people and their parents, let's invite you in so we can hear from everybody, and let's begin to look at where people are stuck right now. Was it that you didn't get enough of a chance to try things on your own, or that you're too afraid of failure, or that you're procrastinating and you're not getting off your laptop in order to exercise? I mean, there's a ton of issues that we could name, each one of these, that have to be, you know, looked at systemically, and I think the solutions are much more readily available when you invite the family.
Well, and on that note, Dr. Rothstein, just to back it up a bit, for a parent who is concerned about their young person's mental health, what should they be looking for to help discern whether this is a bad day or maybe a bad week, or maybe this is the beginning of a mental health crisis? What do parents look for?
Well, again, the derailment from their normal, the young person's normal way of life and of their ability to do things, take care of themselves. You know, if they start to just hang out in their room and they're not coming out, they're not studying when they should be studying or working when they should be working. They're isolating, and they're beginning to look and not look different, right? I mean, all of those are warning signs that maybe your young person is developing a depression. The other piece I will say is that parents themselves have to take care of their own mental health. So that's the other message here, is that if you're feeling like an overburdened parent and that your anxiety is keeping you up at night and you can't sleep, then again, don't just sit there and get more and more anxious. Reach out to somebody professionally, and also reach out to other parents who might be able to give you guidance as to where to get good help.
Yeah, you've got to pull down your own mask first, as they
Correct.
Say on
That's
the planes.
Right, exactly.
We've got a caller. Patty is here with a story that she wants to share with us. Patty, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you. My children are both in their 30s now, but I always felt as a parent the most important thing to teach my children was how to be independent. And I have a little story. Back in 2012, my daughter had just turned 20. She had just finished her sophomore year in college. Her father had died the previous summer, but she and I were taking a trip to Ireland. And we got to Philadelphia Airport, and her passport had expired. The airline very kindly said, you can come on the flight tomorrow. I had just gotten her an iPhone. I said, they told her, go to the U.S. Customs office and you can get walked through to get your passport renewed. And I looked at her. I said, you've got this new phone. You've got your little computer there. You can figure this out. I'll see you in Dublin tomorrow. And she did. She did.
Wow.
She kind of looked at me aghast at first, like,
yep.
You're leaving me? I said, you've lived in New York for 2 years. You can figure this out.
Right. Beautiful.
Yeah.
It's an act of faith on your part, and
beautiful.
Faith in her ability.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And if I might just interject, you've been talking about mental health. My son, in his middle years, in sophomore year in college, developed depression. And it was frightening for us. We didn't really know what to do. But he was the one that said, said, I need help. I need to talk to somebody. And he made it through. It took him a long time, but he is now the proud father of two children and doing very well, has a job and a beautiful family and loving home. So, he instigated the need, the help.
Well, Patty, that's thank great. You so much for sharing about both of your young people with us. It sounds like you've done a good job as a mom, and I think that there's a good message in there for parents. Wouldn't you agree, Julie?
Absolutely. First of all, Patty, kudos to you. Mm-hmm. A beautiful example, daughter in the airport, how you chose to handle it. There are parents listening, particularly 10 years later, which this story, you know, the story was set 10 years earlier, who are saying, my God, Patty, how cruel. But I'm here to say it is not cruel. It is the most loving thing to signal to your child, you've got this. I'm confident you can handle it. Unless it's a true emergency, that is the best role we can play. I want to also say, I totally agree with Tony, that families are key. And as I mentioned earlier, I'm a mom, and I want everyone listening to know I have permission to share. I'm in family therapy. My family, my husband, my son, and I are actively working at repatterning our way of being with him. We have been those over parents. I'm not trying to blame parents. I'm in it myself, okay? I'm not saying parents are enablers. I'm saying parents, can we come to terms with the fact mm-hmm. that we play a role in this? And let's not feel badly about that. Let's be interested in learning and growing. In my house, I'm trying to stop swooping in and solving and instead empathize and empower. With my daughter, when she says, this is wrong and this is wrong and this is wrong, my 21-year-old, I know now not to just try to fix it and tell her what to do. I listen. I empathize. I say, you know, I hear you. Do you want to vent? Do you also want ideas? I'm here for both of those. And then I step back and let her answer. And then I follow her lead. With my son, who's a little bit more sensitive, my temptation is to outright handle his challenging things, my 23-year-old. And I've learned, no, that disempowers him. So what I do is I look at him and I say, Sawyer, you know what? That sounds like it's hard. But you know what? You do hard things. And the first time I said that to him when he was 20, his eyes flew wide open. He's like, I do hard things. And I repeated it. You do hard things. And I said, I'm going to be in my office. If you need me, you know where to find me. But I think you've got this, son. It was one of the most empowering things I have ever done.
Wow. Thank you so much for sharing that, Julie, because yeah, I think really, the message to the rest of us is that even the experts have to course correct right. every now and then. And, you know, we can sort of rethink and rework the way that we are dealing with our young people.
And what you're talking about, Julie, is the capacity for change, that everybody yeah. has a capacity for change, but you have to be willing to explore and to change. And to do change is a lot of work. Yeah. You know, you have right. to do the work. So does, you know, your partner, your husband and the kids, everybody. But when you have everyone working together, there is a much more opportunity for that change to be accelerated, you know, yeah, and everybody yeah. to feel empowered, as you said. I think that's hugely important.
Got a comment here from Margaret, who is 25 years old. And Margaret says, I took a windy path through college, so I'm in my last semester right now. I think many people in my generation receive the message of follow your dreams. I'm curious if the experts have observed this phenomenon as well, something I think is different than in past generations. Dr. Rothstein, what do you say?
Well, first of all, I think everyone should follow their dreams and as best they can. I don't think that's a new message, but I do think that what's different now is that what are your dreams about may be a little bit harder to formulate, because it almost feels like there's this endless sort of endless possibilities out there. How do I grab and hold on to what I'm trying to do? How do I get from here to my dreams? So I do think that, yes, there's a need to, and it's good that you mentioned that you took a winding path, which we're seeing more and more. You know, the average number of years for people to graduate college is up to, you know, close to 6 years now, rather than four. Everybody thinks, you know, 4 years. Well, no, the path takes a little bit longer for people. And it's actually interesting that maybe the detours are really instructive. How do you take that time to figure out who you are? I like to tell the story of how I left college for a year in order to figure myself out, and it made a huge difference in being able to determine my path. So, yeah, it's not, you know, one size fits all, and good luck on pursuing your dreams. And hopefully you'll have people around you who can help you define how to get to that path. The one interesting, and I'd like to hear Julie's comment on this, but the one interesting shift that I see going on is that students want to come in now with some sense of career prep, occupational, vocational readiness. And colleges historically have not done a lot to get students to think about how are they going to fit into the future workforce and where are they going to be in 5 or 10 years. And I think there's a greater demand now for young adults to help them decide What's the best kind of courses to take? You know, and ultimately, it's what are my aptitudes? What are the things that I'm good at and I'm likely to be able to, you know, turn into something that could be a successful career path?
Yeah. Julie, your thoughts?
Well, Margaret, first of all, we're delighted you weighed in here. We really want to be speaking with your generation. Glad you shared. And look, I wrote Your Turn, How to Be an Adult, Margaret, for you and your age group. And it's all about, like, there is no right path. This generation has been told the right path. There isn't one. Mm-hmm. That's a fallacy and a limited way of thinking. There's only the next step that is right for you. You know, the book is filled with stories of people who wound their way to where they are now, stories of people discovering their agency, overcoming limitations in childhood, taking a step that turned out to be problematic, learning from it, and going in a new direction. You know, one of my favorite chapters is called Stop Pleasing Others. They Have No Idea Who You Are. And it pairs with the next chapter, Get Out of Neutral, which is addressing why you may be stuck in a certain place in life, seeking the approval of others, trying to keep your options open. I tell young adults, when your parents say keep your options open, that's their way of saying, I don't like the option you're about to pick. And I'm here rooting for you to pick the option that feels right for you. So, the windy path is a beautiful path, and follow your dreams, but also work hard, hustle, do the work.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Dr. Rothstein, you mentioned a little while ago in the conversation about the concerns that young people have about climate change and a host of other things. And I guess very quickly in the last 2 minutes as we wrap up our conversation, I'd like to hear from both of you, 60 seconds or less, do you think that young people are more or less optimistic generally about the future than generations prior? Dr. Rothstein, and then Julie, you weigh in as well, please.
Well, I think young people are still very optimistic, as by and large, about wanting to make the world a place that is a good place for them, and they want to live in that future. I think what's And by the way, my generation that grew up during the war in Vietnam, we were optimistic about some things, but we were pretty upset about other things. So I don't think optimism is sort of like one size fits all. I think young people want to have a voice, want to play a role, and are very, very quick to point out all the mistakes that we have made in the world. And they're pretty angry about some of them, but they're also I believe they really want to see good change. And I'm very inspired every day. I work with medical students at Rowan, Cooper Medical School of Rowan University. They are amazing in their conviction that their generation is going to be a game changer generation.
Yeah. Julie, what do you say? More or less optimistic?
Yeah, I would say both. I think it is sort of like the Vietnam era in some ways. There are these really scary existential threats, and yet an entire generation of young people who are kinder, more gracious. They've been taught that every human matters. They respect the difference in identities. They understand the climate. They understand technology. They really want us to get out of the way so they can fix things.
Yep.
And I'm here saying, you know what? Amen. We have screwed things up. Let's own that. Let's stand with our young adults and figure out how to solve these big existential threats. There's nothing like an enormous set of problems, if we face them head on, to fuel us, to give us that buzz that says, you know what? I am capable, and I'm going to do something about this. And I think every young adult listening, that's your capability, that's your task. It's go time, and we believe in you.
Well, those sound like a good set of marching orders to me.
Well, I would also add, find the other people who are working to work towards the goal with you so that you're not doing it alone.
Yeah.
And that's really...
Amen.
Amen.
Well said. Well, let me take a moment to thank both of our guests. Julie Lithcott-Hames has been with us, author of How to Raise an Adult, as well as Your Turn, How to Be an Adult. Dr. Anthony Rothstein, the author, co-author of The Stressed Years of Their Lives and the forthcoming You're Not Done Yet. Thank you both so much for being with us on Radio Times.
Thank you
Such
so much. Really,
thank
great
you.
To be here.
Well, we have been talking about parenting young adults. Our producer today was Debbie Builder, also Paige Murray-Bessler. Our engineer has been Al Banks. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moskowain, and you are listening to Radio Times on WHYY.